Today, provide you with in-depth news and expert analysis, tell you the whole story and the bigger picture. Bring you the news you want to know only on Today.
IMF cuts global growth outlook, citing trade war and weak Europe. British Prime Minister Theresa May unveiled her Brexit Plan B, which looks a lot like Plan A. France summons Italy's envoy after the Italian Deputy Prime Minister accused Paris of continuing to colonize Africa. More than 100 Afghan security forces have been killed in Taliban attack. You're listening to Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Zhao Ying. Coming up, we'll have an hour of world news and analysis. To hear this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. The International Monetary Fund on Monday cut its world economic growth forecast for 2019 and 2020 due to weakness in Europe and some emerging markets, and said failure to resolve trade tensions could further destabilize a slowing global economy. In its second downgrade in 3 months, the global lender also cited some risks to its outlook, including no-deal Brexit, saying this could worsen market turbulence in financial markets. The global growth forecast is cut to 3.5% for this year, 3.6% for 2018. 2020, an IMF cuts euro area forecasts on weakness in Germany and Italy. It keeps U.S. and Chinese growth forecasts intact, but warns of potential risks. For more on this, my colleague Zhao Yang was earlier joined by Hans-Peter Berghoff, professor and chair of the Banking and Finance Department at the University of Hohenheim in Germany, and Liu Baocheng, associate professor at University of International Business and Economics.
So, Hans-Peter, first of all, the IMF predicted the global economy will grow at 3.5 this year and 3.6 next year. And this is down to 0.2 and 0.1 percentage point, respectively, from its last October's forecast. So why is this downgrade?
I think we misunderstand this downgrade in a way because it's a kind of average number. I think the reality is worse. Just if we look at the number, the world economy is in a good state. So in a way, nothing bad might happen if nothing happens. But the problem is that there are so many risks. And if one of two of these risks hits the world economy, maybe it can stand that. But if there's a culmination of risks, if there are too much risks coming together, this might lead to an even worse situation than that. So this sounds not so bad. It might be worse.
Yeah. So, Baocheng, full of risks for this year. But is there any silver lining in the global economy this year?
Well, for the last 3 years, we noticed there was a parallel growth around the globe. And now when the U.S. economy is strong, that's still good news. And China maintains rather resilient in its growth level. So when the two largest economies are serving as a denominator, that really is a silver lining. That also gave confidence to the whole world economic policymakers. As I said, there are a lot of uncertainties going on. One is the Brexit with no deal. The other would be that there is still a possibility that China and the U.S. cannot really agree on what was discussed, and the looming trade war has not really seen the end of the truce. So that's also something uncertain. And the another silver lining could be, okay, there can be some breakthrough of the technology, particularly in the 5G application, the driverless, the cars putting on road.
So this is technology development or advancement, right?
That's right. That's right. So technology gave people confidence, although it may not immediately translate into worldwide utility yet. So investors are still very hesitant. They have money in hand. And it's not really too bad. It's far from being a recession. So it's really a haircut by the IMF forecast.
Mm-hmm. Although I think, may I say something to that? Usually there's an American saying, it's the economy stupid. I'd say now it's the other way around. It's politics stupid. Because what we observe is a grown inability to coordinate our global interests between China, the U.S., between Europe and the U.S., within the U.S., within Europe. This is a grown problem, and if we are not able to solve these political problems, this will have very bad repercussions in the economy. Mm. But we are still fighting, so we really don't know what will happen. But that's also bad for investors, for sure. They hate this uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. So, Baocheng, do you have a high level of anxiety about the global stock market, a slowdown in the economic growth, and the international politics?
Yes, as my partner says, the uncertainty and unpredictability gave a strong fuel for anxiety among investors, so therefore there's such a hesitation. China-U.S. trade issue and also the threatening of the paralyzing dispute settlement system within the WTO. Mm-hmm. And although a number of proposals have been listed, whether U.S. will come to terms for defending the global trading system, that's also another big uncertainty. And so also when the emerging economies are trying to stretch, but the Latin American do not really see much of the prospect, well, Asia's emerging economies is going to turn out to be stronger, particularly if you look at the India's growth forecast by IMF. So that's also very encouraging. So it's a very mixed picture. Mm. Fragmentation is really the key that purports the uncertainty that is lying ahead.
Mm. And now let's take a look at those specific issues or regions one by one. Hans-Peter, firstly, how do you think will the trade tensions and uncertainties looming ahead impact the business investment and business confidence? And how could it dent the financial market sentiment and further dampen the growth?
Well, up to now, it doesn't touch it as much as it maybe should, because still in the business, there's the idea there must be a way to rational solutions. It feels a little bit like in summer 2008, when everybody said there's maybe a banking crisis, but we are sure there must be a solution, so there will be no real bad damage, and the stock prices are still very high. But there is a certain probability that there won't be no rational solution, no solution which is good to some degree, at least, for everybody. And so I think it might hurt much more in the future when people become aware that not all these problems will be solved in a decent way.
Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
also,
figuratively, you know, businesses are keeping their fingers crossed upward and keep the other hand, the thumb downward.
Mm. And also, Hans-Peter, I also want to talk about Europe. Growth in Eurozone is set to moderate from 1.8% last year to 1.6% this year. So what are the main problems for the Eurozone economy?
Well, they are very different because the Eurozone is very diverse. Let me give you my country where our growth rates have gone down very much. This has some, I call them even positive reasons. We just simply don't have enough qualified people which could work on this economic success. And on the one hand, the growth rates have been very good in the past, so there must have been some correction because we're just at the upper line of what we could reach with our population. For Southern Europe, there's still the state debt crisis looming up combined with the banking crisis, and all these problems are to some degree unresolved, although the general public and the politicians have moved their focus to somewhere else because they just solved the problem with a lot of money. So there's a lot of tension in Europe, and for sure, there's Brexit, there's France, which is destabilizing. We have this, as I said, it's politics. We've got the fact that in many countries, it gets harder and harder to get a stable government, especially in a country like Germany, where we've gone really very, very stable politically in the past, and now it's really difficult to find a coalition. We need three-party coalitions now, maybe even four-party coalitions. This is really unstable compared to the very solid two-party coalitions we had in the past.
Mm. And also, Germany has already registered a technical recession, and also Italy under the market pressure due to Rome's recent budget standoff with the European Union. So what are the risks for Eurozone economy, Hans-Peter?
Other risk, well,
Brexit,
said,
of course.
Brexit, of course, and we simply don't know what will happen, but the damage will be definitely there. There's on the one hand all these production chains, which include Great Britain, which must be reorganized, which is pretty costly. There's a loss of direct access of Europe to the London Financial Center, which is simply the global financial center, and also bad for London that it loses the direct access to the European Union. So both will suffer a lot. Capital allocation will be less efficient. The availability of capital for large, risky projects will be reduced. All this is very negative. Mm. And on the other hand, we've got a banking crisis in Southern Europe, in Greece, in Italy. We've got the lack of profitability of banking due to overshooting regulation and many other things, high competition. So there are lots of problems. But on the other hand, Europe is still a great place to do business because you've got a very stability. You've got legal systems which, at least in some countries, function very, very well. So plus and minus. The problem is really to say today, what will happen? Which will risk prevail, or will the positive aspect prevail? I know we economists are paid to give some view into the future, but sometimes it's not really reliable to say something.
Mm. And so, Bao Cheng, I also want to talk with you about the emerging market and developing economies this year. How will the trade tensions, the rising U.S. interest rates, dollar appreciation, capital outflows, et cetera, affect them?
Well, the whole world is really integrated, although politicians do not really see this picture in terms of business. So the global value chain is still in a reshaping process, and they are being more and more intertwined. So therefore, the emerging economies are really facing the challenge on two fronts. One is they want to edge onto made or high-end manufacturing, where the access to cutting-edge technology is still the uphill battle. And so it takes time for them to stand on themselves on the cutting-edge technology, particularly in terms of the large-scale manufacturing. And the other is that, there is growing demand at home. Middle class is still on the rise. And how to fulfill this need, and also how to bridge the gap. That's something still very much a challenge for those emerging economies. But having said that, they will come out again as a major driver for global growth. So they really contribute to the silver lining of economic forecast.
And so what about the emerging markets, hence, Peter? Do you agree with Bao Cheng?
I'm not so sure. I'm not so positive at the moment because these kind of, nationalistic trends in the west, in the northern and western part of the world also will tend to threaten cooperative policies with these countries. And they need access to our markets. They need cooperative policies as well. This would be very helpful for them. Let me give an example. Increasing regulation, for example, in the banking sector makes it more and more difficult to make joint businesses. And the trade policies where China can play hardball with the United States, these countries cannot play hardball. They're just forgotten. And that's a threat also to this development. In the past, we had more interest in these emerging markets, and this maybe helped to get on a sustainable development path. This is threatened also by this nationalistic and egoistic policies we have now in many countries.
Hence, Peter Berghoff, professor and chair of the Banking and Finance Department at the University of Hohenheim in Germany, and Liu Baocheng, associate professor at University of International Business and Economics, speaking with my colleague Zhao Yan. Coming up, British Prime Minister Theresa May unveiled her Brexit Plan B. You're listening to Today. We'll be back in a minute.
I am Alka Acharya. I teach at the Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. Today has organized its programs and a stress on bringing in a lot of views from all over. It is an extremely good platform for information and analysis, and I wish it all success in the future.
Welcome back. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. British Prime Minister Theresa May has an alternate Brexit plan after Parliament voted overwhelmingly to reject her deal to divorce the European Union. May says she will now seek concessions from the EU on a controversial policy that calls for no hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. However, she also rejected demands by opposition MPs to hold a second referendum on whether the UK should leave the EU.
The only other guaranteed way to avoid a no-deal Brexit is to revoke Article 50, which would mean staying in the EU. There are others who think that what we need is more time, so they say we should extend Article 50 to give longer for Parliament to debate how we should leave and what a deal should look like. This is not ruling out no deal, but simply deferring the point of decision.
MPs are free to amend May's Plan B and are set to vote on the Prime Minister's motion and the amendments on January the 29th. For more on this, we're now joined on the line by Dennis Campbell, founder and editor of UK Progressive magazine. So, Dr. Campbell, how do you read Theresa May's Plan B?
Well, it's sort of like the script of the Bill Murray film Groundhog Day. Now, for your listeners, it's a quaint holiday in the United States that annually puts Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, on the map because of a groundhog named Phil. He pops out of his burrow, looks around. If he sees a shadow, he scurries back into his hole, and we have 6 more weeks of winter. If he doesn't, he stays out and winter's over. And then the film Murray continues to wake up every day, and it's still February 2nd, Groundhog Day, and nothing's changed. This is how we feel about 2 years of Brexit negotiation nonsense. Every day we wake up to more craziness. But it's the same craziness. It never changes, nor does May's threshold for humiliation. Plan B's only change is cancelling the £65 fee for EU settlers. And she says we're going to continue to negotiate a better border with Northern Ireland, also known as the backstop. You know, Germany's minister just came out 10 minutes ago, Katharina Barley, who's there, who's also a German and British citizen and the Social Democrats candidate for EU elections, saying, you know, she's in favor of a second referendum, that Theresa May is presenting a plan B that's hardly worth the paper it's written on, arguing her main aim at this stage is to play for time. But in doing so, she's playing with fire. So they're supposed to vote next Tuesday, but there are so many amendments already tabled, thanks to Speaker Bercow, by the way, is also a Conservative, not allowing the government to bully the Commons, a move that could cost him a peerage when he steps down this summer. And, I mean, it just continues to get crazier. You literally have to stay on the ticker every minute of every day. Dominic Grieve, 10 minutes ago, a backbencher, put his motion forward to allow them to set up all these different 6 full days of debates that are going to tackle every single item on the referendum: customs union, Labour's own Brexit plan, a second referendum, no deal, the Norway model. All these motions would be amendable and have a political force.
But last week, Theresa May said he would focus on cross-party talks to get a Brexit deal accepted by the Parliament. But now she says she will instead demand concessions from the EU on the Northern Ireland backstop. What do you make of such changes?
Well, this is more of the same from both Tories and Labour's. I mean, Theresa May has gone off again, once again, as she did in December, with her begging bowl in hand. But she has no real interest in talking to other parties. Indeed, she, like, I guess, Donald Trump, wishes she was a dictator and could dispense with this democracy inconvenience. Labour's not going to participate, now demanding a guarantee that we're not going to crash out of the EU. I mean, Yvette Cooper has tabled a bill to prevent that, and May is worried her backbenchers will join in. They want a so-called free vote to be able to vote their conscience versus toe the party line.
The EU chief Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier said that the withdrawal agreement, with all its dimensions, including the backstop, is the best deal possible. What do you make of this? I mean, will EU be willing to make any further concessions?
Well, there's a general panic right now because, you know, crashing out, and this I'm talking about the EU side, you know, the crashing out means Britain doesn't pay its £39 billion divorce settlement fee. That's a lot of money. Also, the rights of settled EU residents here and customs issues in Dover, none of these are resolved. Dover and Calais are going to be absolute standstills. They're even questioning if UK driving license will be legal going forward to drive on the continent. So there's a host of issues surrounding a no-deal Brexit that affect their countrymen and women, not even talking about what's going to happen here in the UK.
So do you feel that Brexit is now actually out of Theresa May's hands and that the Parliament is taking control of Brexit to set the terms for it?
Well, she's been handed a real dog's breakfast here. I mean, her own party has basically gone against her, with all the people that were so much for Brexit immediately resigning from her parliament. And then even the man that negotiated the Brexit deal, David Davis, resigned from the government, from the parliament. So it's like we have all these rats that are deserting the sinking ship, and then now they're sitting on the sidelines, and 100 of them went across the aisle and voted with the other side. So you've got this situation where we're probably headed for no Brexit whatsoever, a second referendum, or at very least postponement until the end of the year.
So what are some of the rival plans that have already been put forward by the MPs?
Well, I mean, I'm literally watching the ticker on The Guardian. As of this moment, I mentioned Labour's Yvette Cooper, her deal. She basically wants to tie May's hands and rule out a no-deal Brexit when we crash out. This one is concerning because the Tories want a free vote, and up to 40 members of the government could resign without it. Vince Cable, leader of the Liberal Democrats, wants to see a second referendum. He and his party have been very, very big, the people's vote followers. The Tories, under Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson, they just want to see Theresa May destroyed. You know, they abandon her in Parliament, and Brexit has created this inter-party mutiny. And even Nigel Farage, the man who was the most familiar face, is no longer in UKIP. He sounded moderate this past week because he's going to lose his EU Parliament job this year. So he's looking for a new gig. So you've got all these competing plans floating around, and so far the best deal is at this moment no deal, or just sort of saying, look, we tried and we failed. Let's have a second referendum. And I don't see either of those coming without a huge fight.
Well, talking about the second referendum, actually, Theresa May warned that it could damage social cohesion by undermining faith in democracy. So do you feel that another referendum would be more damaging because, as May argued, it sets precedents?
Well, you know, the referendum, when it was taken 2 years ago in June of 2016, was always non-binding. But the problem is nobody ever saw it that way. The Tories are the ones who convinced everyone this was the will of the people. Now, not so much. I mean, there was a report literally released 30 minutes ago that says identification with Remain or Leave is much stronger than identification with the political party. You know, since the referendum, Remain and Leave, it's been almost 50-50. But only 1 in 16 people don't have a Brexit identity, whereas more than 1 in 5 have no party identity. So this is creating a huge political dilemma. He's trying to say it's basically a debate between the many and the few. He may be right, but the research suggests that this is not the way people feel at the moment, that we're headed towards, you know, March 29th, Article 50 withdrawal date. Now, she could petition the EU to request an extension until July of the end of the year, which, you know, she's already said she's going to resign as the party leader. She could get her second bill passed, but how is she going to convince the 232 voters that abandoned her? So she could crash us out, and there's nothing in place that stops that, or we go on to a second referendum.
So do you feel they are more likely to have a no-deal Brexit at the moment?
Not sure anyone would go for a no deal except the far-right Tories. I mean, that's the biggest problem, is that they're the ones that are banging the drum, but they are the ones that also abandon the government. It's a crazy situation that the ones that pushed this so very hard for 2 years are now not involved at all in any way in the government or deciding it, because they all resigned out of protest because Theresa May was trying to be a conciliator and bring sides together when they just wanted to burn the whole house down.
Mm-hmm. And on the timing of the Brexit, do you feel that perhaps more time is needed to make some of the arrangements, even if the British Parliament can agree on a modified version of Theresa May's deal?
Well, I mean, just this morning, they've announced that the Commons is going to forego their February recess break. They're going to sit through weekends, so it's going to be a very tense time for the next 8 weeks or so as they try to get Brexit done by the 29th of March. But the betting money is on a delay. I don't think Theresa May's modified version is going to go anywhere. That's probably dead on arrival. You know, you're just waiving a fee, and you're basically saying, you know, this is the direction we're going to go in. I think the betting money is on the delay. I mean, French President Macron called it one of the three ways this thing can go in very stark terms. And I don't think the public will stand for... See, the public didn't know. They were lied to because of the interference on Facebook and every place else. They don't really know what they voted for back in June of 2016. Now they know, and they don't like the idea of crashing out of the single market or the customs union or any of the maladies that could face us going forward. So as the advertisers say, watch this space.
So what do you think the Europe is now looking for? I mean, EU is looking for from the British government at the moment.
Well, the EU's been pretty arrogant. I mean, they've really sat back and, you know, and they have the right to be. I mean, it's basically 27 nations against one. And the United Kingdom basically walked into negotiations 2 years ago with the attitude, you're not going to let us go because you can't live without us. Well, the EU said, yeah, we can, because we're 27 countries. You're one little island with 60 million people. We've got 350 million people in the European Union, you know, in a very big market. So you're going to have to play ball. Any one of the 27 nations can veto any deal that's brought forward. And I don't think anybody's taken it seriously until probably about 6-8 weeks ago.
Okay, thank you, Dennis Campbell, founder and editor of UK Progressive magazine. Coming up, France summons Italy's envoy after the Italian deputy prime minister accused Paris of continuing to colonize Africa. More than 100 Afghan security forces have been killed in Taliban attack. To hear this episode again or catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. You're listening to Today. Stay with us.
ChinaPlus.CRI.CN is your home for everything you want to know about China.
The latest news in China and everything China-related from around the world.
Everything in focus, all in one place. Bringing you vital information for your business and travel.
Chinese culture, language learning and more.
ChinaPlus.CRI.CN.
ChinaPlus.CRI.CN. Your portal into today's Middle Kingdom.
You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Now is Global Survey, where we look at what's happening around the world. Joining me in the studio is Patrick Flannery.
Tonight we begin in Asia, where a Chinese study finds that cigarette smokers and those who drink alcohol appear less likely to suffer from depression. India's opposition Congress Party has appointed its first ever transgender general secretary of its women's wing.
In Oceania, two Colombian sisters visiting New Zealand say they were randomly attacked at an Auckland mall. Australian police say a man was reading a book while driving on a busy Melbourne freeway.
In Africa, sports gambling is now banned in Uganda because the president says sports betting companies are distracting too many young people. Zimbabwe's government went too far when it blocked the internet during a recent protest, a court has recently ruled.
In the Middle East, Qatar will inject $500 million into Lebanon's economy, which has the world's third highest public debt. An Egyptian court has sentenced a TV journalist to a year in jail for interviewing a gay man.
In Europe, Greenland's ice is melting too fast, a study finds, and it may become a major contributor to sea level rise within 20 years. Romania's justice minister says he will invalidate hundreds of corruption cases involving many of the country's top officials.
In Latin America, Brazilian authorities say they discovered cash transfers worth $25,000 into the account of President Bolsonaro's son. Two Israeli sisters traveling in the Argentine city of Mendoza have been missing for more than a week.
Finally, tonight in North America, the U.S. government shutdown has some furloughed federal workers turning to pawn shops and brokers for short-term loans. And in the 10 years since the financial crisis, the number of billionaires has nearly doubled, according to the development charity Oxfam.
Thank you, Patrick. That's the Global Headlines survey for today. France has summoned Italy's ambassador to protest about comments by Italian Deputy Prime Minister Luigi Di Maio, who accused Paris of continuing to colonize Africa and causing people to migrate from the continent. On Sunday, Luigi Di Maio called on the European Union to impose sanctions on France for its policies in Africa, saying that Africans should be in Africa, not at the bottom of the Mediterranean. He said France had never stopped colonizing tens of African states. The International Organization for Migration said at the weekend that more than 100 people were feared missing after a boat carrying migrants capsized off the coast of Libya. For more on this, we're now joined on the line by George Zagopoulos, Senior Research Fellow of International Center for European Studies. Good evening, Dr. Zagopoulos.
Good evening, and thank you for having me.
So what is your take on the Italian Deputy Prime Minister's comments saying that countries like France have impoverished Africa and made people there to leave?
Well, this Italian government is having an anti-immigration agenda. This is clear. This is how it was elected last year. And what it is doing right now is that it is reiterating similar comments. This time it is publicly attacking France because it believes the responsibility that France takes in the context of the refugee crisis is not fair vis-à-vis countries like Italy, which are sharing a much larger burden. And because this government has been successful in investing in an agenda, in an anti-refugee agenda, it is continuing the same policy and the same political communication approach. So I regard these French-Italian disagreement and the stance of the Italian government as a continuation of the same policy which had started before the Italian election last year.
Yeah, actually, it reminds us of what happened last year when France criticized Italy for not allowing rescue boats carrying migrants in the Mediterranean to dock. And Italian officials responded by accusing France itself of refusing to accept those migrants. So what exactly is behind the two governments' tensions on migrant issue?
Well, it is clear that Italy is not prepared to accept more refugees. Just to give you an overview of the situation right now, there are two main countries, Greece and Italy, which are suffering by the refugee crisis. And as far as Italy is concerned, the problem starts with refugees arriving from Africa and also North African countries because they find it easy to reach Italy by boat. The complaint of the Italian government is that more Italian ports in comparison to French ports accept the refugees. And that's why now we are observing that the Italian government is asking France, for example, the port of Marseille, to also play a role in the context of the refugee crisis. All this is about how solidarity is viewed in the European Union. And Italy believes that this solidarity is expressed and demonstrated to a much larger extent in Italy in comparison to France.
So do you see this as actually another sign of the serious tensions between the populist government in Rome and France's centrist leader Emmanuel Macron? Because we know that earlier, De Mao has also recently backed the Yellow Vest protesters in France.
Well, you are right. What the Italian government and De Mao, as you correctly suggesting, is doing, is attempting also not only to employ in an anti-refugee rhetoric, but also to present himself as a political leader who is defending the rights of the workers. So I wouldn't necessarily see that in that regard there is a tendency of the Maio and of the Italian government to attack the French. It is mainly an effort from their side to show to Italian citizens suffering by the economic crisis that they are prepared to defend their own rights, the rights of the workers. We see that this is also happening at the EU level. So Italy is a country right now which is not necessarily agreeing with the fiscal rules which are imposed by the European Union. It's attempting a little bit to bring some flexibility in order for Italian citizens to live under better living conditions. But certainly, as you are suggesting, the fact that Di Maio shared the cause of the Yellow Vest suggests that this Italian government is following a completely different agenda from the one of the previous of the election before.
And Italy's far-right interior minister Matteo Salvini said earlier this month that populists from Italy and Poland should spark a European spring to replace the centre-right influence of Germany and France ahead of the European parliamentary elections. So do you think the right-wing populist parties will be represented even more strongly in parliament than they already are after the elections in May? And what impact will that bring to the continent?
This is a great question. This is actually what is being discussed these days in Brussels and in other European capitals. Up to what extent that kind of initiatives led by Italy and Poland, for instance, might lead voters across member states in order to vote for European partners that are not necessarily Eurosceptic, but are not happy with the current modus operandi of the European Union. I find it very worrying, and in my view, what we will expect in the next months will be that several parties in Europe, which are not happy with the policy of the European Union vis-à-vis the refugee crisis and the economic crisis, will form an agenda in order to attract voters who are not happy also with that kind of policies. So what I would expect is that in the next European Parliament election next May, we will see many parties which share this view to gain voices in Brussels and in Strasbourg. This does not necessarily mean that pro-EU parties will not be able to collaborate, but it would be more difficult for them if the effort of Italy and Poland will be efficient and successful.
So what do you think will be the key to combat such kind of rise of right-wing populism in Europe? I mean, will the issue of migration be the key of that problem?
Certainly, it is the migration and the refugee crisis, and the experience of European politics in last years suggests that the refugee crisis is having a much larger impact in comparison to the economic crisis. And what is largely happening is that in times of crisis, governments and political parties, as it's happening in Italy, are attempting to benefit and exploit the situation in order to attract disenchanted voters. So also history suggests that when a crisis breaks out, it is easy for parties who are investing in populist agendas to gain ground. So this is what we are expecting to happen in the European Parliament election, but also at the national level, there are several countries that might like to follow the paradigm of Italy if that will be successful in the medium and long term.
Well, the Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, recently said in an interview that Europe's failed policies in Africa are the drivers of the immigration crisis hitting the European continent because their investment in Africa has a return ticket. And that sounds quite similar to the comments by the Italian deputy prime minister. Do you think he has a point?
You are right. It is similar to the comment of the Italian government, and possibly the agenda of the Italian government has been influenced a little bit in that regard in the last months by these remarks. I believe that the African leader has meant is that European countries, mainly France, have invested in Africa, but their main interest was to bring the money back to Europe and to France in that regard, instead of also giving many opportunities to African people. And that's why what is happening is that several African people are not happy with the living conditions in several African countries, but want to go back to Europe. And this is certainly having a serious impact on the wave of refugees going from Africa to Europe. In that regard, I would also like to add that the role of China in Africa is a little bit different from that of France and other European countries, because Chinese investments, as opposed to French and European ones, are also having an important and efficient impact within countries themselves. And that's why the image of China in comparison to France and other European countries in Africa remains positive.
Well, actually, many are saying that Africa countries, they are still struggling to attain economic independence, even years after they gained political independence from the colonial empires. Do you agree? And what do you think are the key challenges there?
Well, I agree. But at the same time, the existing challenges like unemployment and poverty and the improvement of living conditions should be on the agenda of international organizations such as the United Nations. And we see that they are trying to play a role in order to help the countries. But what is more important to suggest is that African countries do not necessarily have to rely on external countries. They have also to take their own responsibility. And in that regard, they should see at foreign investments, including the Chinese ones, as an opportunity for them to further grow in order to meet the current challenges such as poverty. And again, the role of China is of high significance because it contributes to the fight of problems such as poverty, as well as to the improvement of living conditions, including the construction of hospitals, the dispatch of Chinese doctors who are playing a critical role there in fighting against important diseases. So I think that a combination of the local culture with foreign investments, including from China, can help Africa to efficiently deal with its challenges.
Thank you, Dr. George Zagopoulos, Senior Research Fellow of International Center for European Studies. Coming up, more than 100 Afghan security forces have been killed in Taliban attack. You're listening to Today. We'll be back in a minute.
As a guest speaker with Today, I feel very much grateful for providing a chance for me to communicate to the world and China's progress and China's accomplishment and also China's rich cultural heritage and, of course, China's desire to integrate itself into the international community. I believe Today opens a window as well as build a bridge between people in China and the world.
This is Today. I'm Zhao Ying. The Taliban has launched a major attack on a military compound in the central Afghan province of Maidan Wardak. It's been suggested the death toll could be as many as more than 100 people. The attack began on Monday morning when the armored vehicles exploded after bumping into the compound. At least two gunmen followed up the car bomb before they were killed. The attack came hours before the Taliban announced they had resumed talks with American officials in Qatar. With more on this, we are now joined on the line by Professor Saad Jawad, Senior Fellow with the Middle East Center of London School of Economics and Political Science. Professor Jawad, the military training center under attack this time belongs to the Afghan intelligence agency. And compared to the Afghan police and army, many say that the intelligence forces are usually better trained and equipped. So why do we see such a large casualty there?
Well, unfortunately, it seems that they are not better trained and equipped. And maybe Taliban chose this camp in order to show that they are more superior and to show how fragile is the intelligence and the security forces of the Afghan government, although protected by the United States.
And seven police officers and one intelligence officer were killed in a similar deadly attack in the neighboring Logar province on Sunday. So how would you explain the recent increase in the intensity of the Taliban attacks?
Well, when you think that the United States or President Trump is highly thinking of pulling out his forces from Afghanistan, and when you think that the central government in Afghanistan is still undecided and divided and nobody knows who's going to win the new elections, and when you find that the Americans are not ready to continue to support this government, and as Mr. Trump decided to pull out of Syria and now out of Afghanistan, you can think that Taliban feels and thinks that they are better fit to fill the vacuum left by the United States. And that's why, and another proof of that, of course, the talks between the United States and Taliban in Afghanistan, something that was not happening in the last years or a few years. So one can think what pushed Taliban to go ahead and increase their activities.
So do you feel this is Taliban's tactic to gain more leverage in its talks with the U.S. officials? And do you think that is going to work?
Well, up till now it's working because the United States did not stop the talks in Afghanistan, in Qatar, and did not order the Taliban to stop their activities, and they are still considering their demands. And more than that, they are involving the Pakistan government in the talks. So I think it's working.
So what are some of the thorny issues in the talks between the Taliban and the U.S. envoy?
Yeah, there are many issues. The first issue was the Taliban prisoners in Pakistan and with the Americans. They want the release of these people. Then there is the ban on the travel of Taliban leaders and regarding them as a terrorist organization. There is also the timetable of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and the future government and what the Taliban accept to of the United States to leave in Afghanistan of military forces or bases. These are thorny issues because the United States, although wants to leave Afghanistan, but the Americans do not want to leave it altogether. They want to have some pressure and some influence there. And this is another subject of talk between the two sides.
Well, the Afghan government is dissatisfied that it has been marginalized in the talks in Doha. What do you make of this?
Well, the Afghan government or successive governments have always been marginalized and sidelined by the United States and by the Taliban, because as everybody knows, that it has no force on the ground, no presence on the ground, no supporters. The only side that supports them is the United States, and because they are against Taliban. Now, if they go and have an agreement with Taliban, what should they do with the government of Afghanistan? That's why it's very the government is in a very fragile and very weak position.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, the Trump administration has ordered the military to begin withdrawing some 7,000 American troops from Afghanistan in the coming months. But considering the current situation in the country, how do you think the withdrawal plan will advance?
Well, sometimes, as we have heard in Syria and in Iraq before that the orders of the presidents are not followed exactly as they come out. In Syria, there was an order, but now the Pentagon and the CIA and the foreign ministry interfered and ordered a slowdown of the pullover of the withdrawal. So I should think something similar could happen in Afghanistan. I don't think they will jeopardize everything on all the area, although Afghanistan is not as vital as Syria because of the presence of Israel. But I think also a lot of allies of the United States in the area would like to see the United States slowing down the withdrawal. But I think with Mr. Trump in power, I think he is going to go ahead with the withdrawal and will pull out most of the forces from Afghanistan.
So, ultimately, do you think any settlement could be reached between the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the United States?
Well, the more important is settlement between the Taliban and the United States. I don't think the government could be a hurdle or be an obstacle for the agreement. But I think if the Taliban reach an agreement with the United States, then the Taliban could be the ruling party or the power in Afghanistan. But if they are clever enough, the Taliban, they should themselves start a national negotiation to reach a settlement or reach an agreement with all the forces in Afghanistan. But up to now, Taliban did not show this trend of reconciliation.
Thank you, Professor Saad Jawad from London School of Economics and Political Science. Let's take a short break here. Coming back, Chinese scientists fired for gene editing babies, and a Japanese kindergarten asks kids to be topless in what's called naked education. You're listening to Today. Stay with us.
ChinaPlus.CRI.CN is your home for everything you want to know about China.
The latest news in China and everything China-related from around the world.
Everything in focus, all in one place. Bringing you vital information for your business and travel.
Chinese culture, language learning and more.
ChinaPlus.CRI.CN.
ChinaPlus.CRI.CN. Your portal into today's Middle Kingdom.
Welcome back. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Now joining us for other news is Patrick Flannery.
Zhao Ying, the Chinese scientist who created the first genetically edited babies a few months ago. Remember that? Mm-hmm. He's been fired by his university. He Jiankui violated an ethical boundary, they say, when he used technology to manipulate the embryonic genes of twin girls. Simply put, he deliberately created a gene-edited baby knowing it was the wrong thing to do. That's according to the Health Commission of China. And the genetic scientist community now says being fired is nowhere near the punishment he deserves. What they want is criminal prosecution.
So is this a matter of ethics or a matter of law? How do you prosecute offenders in this case, since it's the first of its kind?
Yeah, this is tough, and we'd like to leave that to our listeners somewhat here tonight, because scientists and scholars seem to disagree. They want legal action. They argue that an example should be made of this scientist to prevent others from pursuing what they're calling illegal human embryo gene editing. But what law did he break is up for debate. You can't really outlaw something that didn't exist before. Chinese scholars say there's a 15-year-old guideline on the books that bans altered embryos from being implanted for reproduction, but that is a guideline. It's not a law. So scientists are now calling for an international treaty on gene editing. That's how far this has gone.
Mm-hmm. So why did his university decide to fire him?
It was the Southern University of Science and Technology in Shenzhen, and it decided that he violated academic ethics because he knew the technology was not safe. He raised the money himself. That was a violation. And according to Xinhua, had forged ethical review papers, which was another ethical breach. And this news comes tonight, Zhao Ying. At the same time, we've learned that a second woman who participated in this scientist experiment has also become pregnant.
Well, I think this is perhaps a case to show that why the law should be updated according to the development in the human society.
Certainly, yeah, this is something that they're really going to have to take a look at, because there doesn't seem to be any precedent.
Yes.
This is really the first, now the second incident.
Yes, let's move on to our next topic.
We're talking about going topless tonight. Around the world, it's often a bold statement. Most recently, a group of women held a topless protest to support the Saudi refugee whom Canada granted amnesty. Tonight, though, we're talking about 5-year-old children going shirtless at school, something that isn't their choice. It turns out that naked education, as it's often called, has been a part of many Japanese kindergartens for 50 years now. It's part of the Japanese philosophy of persevering, no matter how high the stakes. And so many schools require these young students to go naked from the waist up all day long, no matter how cold or hot the weather is outside. This week, there's been renewed uproar online as people are just now discovering this cultural tradition on social media.
So what are the advantages the Japanese schools claim when it comes to wearing very little clothing?
Well, it's said that a bare upper body in freezing temperatures can stimulate brain development for children. It brings them closer to nature, brings them closer to themselves, builds physical toughness. They're said to become more adaptable and more active earlier in life. And a Washington Post article we found from 1990 referred to what one school in Japan called the Naked Prize, and that was where these shirtless kindergartners would compete for bragging rights over who survived the winter without once putting on a shirt.
Well, is there any research proving that these techniques work?
It seems that it's more of a philosophy, but it is worth pointing out that just 2 days ago, the world's oldest man died. He was 113, and he was Japanese. Now, how'd he do it? He said he lived so long because he enjoyed soaking in hot springs and also eating sweets.
So do whatever you want makes you live longer.
It seems so. He was half naked, but it was while he was taking a hot bath.
Yeah. Thank you, Patrick. That's all the time we have for this edition of Today. A quick recap of today's headline news. IMF cuts global growth outlook, citing trade war and weak Europe. British Prime Minister Theresa May unveiled her Brexit Plan B, which looks a lot like Plan A. And France summons Italy's envoy after the Italian Deputy Prime Minister accused Paris of continuing to colonize Africa. And more than 100 Afghan security forces have been killed in Taliban attack. To listen to this episode again or catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. The program engineer of this episode is Zhou Shuping. I'm Zhao Ying. Thank you so much for listening.